More and more women are being imprisoned in the U.S. and around the world. Our next guest explains why this is happening in her new book. Julia Sudbury is the editor of Global Lockdown. Julia spoke to us from Toronto, where she is the current Canada Research Chair in Social Justice, Equity, and Diversity. Your second book is fresh off the printing press. It's a collection of 20 articles from scholars around the globe about the criminalization of poor women of color. Can you tell me a bit more about what's inside?
Yes, definitely. Well, first of all, I should say it's actually a collection of articles by scholars, activists, and former prisoners. So it's a really a collaborative project that includes lots of different voices, and I really want to emphasize the work by former prisoners and activists because they've put a lot of work into, you know, documenting their stories. So basically, it's a book that tries to make connections between different social movements. So thinking about what are the connections between the prison abolitionist movement and the anti-globalization movement, or what are the connections between people working on immigrant rights issues and prison issues, or why should anti-war activists know about prisons? So it's really coming from an activist point of view. And really creating some opportunities to build connections across those different types of activism.
Currently, have you found that there are many connections between these groups? Have they been working together?
There's been less connection between the activism than there is on the ground. So, for example, in the first section of the book, which is called Criminalizing Survival, a couple of the articles talk about the ways in which, of course, immigrants have been criminalized and the real build-up in prison systems in the U.S., obviously, but also in places like Britain and Italy and also in Canada is very much connected to the criminalization and incarceration of immigrants prior to deportation oftentimes, right? So those issues are there, the connections are there, people are documenting them, and what we're trying to do is to get folks who are doing activist work on the ground to start building connections actually between those different movements.
In the book, you talk about the drug trade, and can you tell me about the women that are used as drug mules?
Yeah, that's actually a chapter that I contributed from actually meeting and speaking with women who've been incarcerated in Britain. They're actually women from Jamaica, and I was pretty shocked because I was born in a small town in the south of England called Winchester, and I always walked past the local prison, but without really thinking about it as a kid. And so when I started doing some of this activist work around prisons, I obviously went home and I decided to go inside the prison. Now, this town, when I was growing up, was pretty white. I was like one of the few black kids. I think there was maybe six black kids in a school of like 800 or something. So it's not a city that you really think of as particularly diverse or multicultural. And when I went into this prison, all I came across was so many black women. And so I started talking to these women, and many of them were Jamaican. And so I became really fascinated with their stories, and they really wanted to share their stories and to get the word out there. So what I discovered was that some of the women had been duped. They'd been asked by a friend of a friend, can you take, you know, this can of Ackies and give it to so-and-so, and it had turned out to have drugs in. Some of them knew what they were doing, but they were getting very little money for it, and they weren't necessarily aware of what the risks were. One woman said to me, well, I thought that if I was caught, I would just be deported back home, and, you know, I didn't have anything to lose because, you know, my kid was sick, I needed to get some money to pay for the hospital. So what I decided to do was to do this, and if I get deported, then, okay, you know, I'm back to square one. Of course, she didn't realize she was going to end up with a 7-year prison sentence. So I think it was really important to sort of trace back these stories and to look at what were the reasons why women were making these choices. It wasn't that these were women who had a lot of different options, and I really thought it was important for us to sort of look at the global economy, look at Jamaica's position within that economy, and to see that, you know, there's basically three options for women. They can work in the tourist trade, in the sex industry oftentimes, and that's mostly only available for younger women. They can try and get a job in the free trade zones, and again, there's a real focus on, you know, recruiting young exploitable women there. or they can get working in the drug industry as mules. And really, this is about women's survival, and that was what I tried to show in that article.
So mostly you're finding that these women are ending up in prison because of economic problems.
Every single woman had a different story to tell, and there was maybe one woman who I would say was middle class and didn't have economic problems, and she had been duped, and so she really didn't know. Maybe two women in that situation, but the vast majority of women, in fact all of the women who had made a choice and actually made a decision to import drugs, had done it basically because they were promised, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, and that was going to pay for their children's school fees for the year, or that was going to pay for a hospital bill because a child had become ill. And I think it's really important for us to sort of understand that these are not welfare states that are well-funded, right? People don't have free education. People don't have free healthcare. And so in those situations, oftentimes the burden falls on women's shoulders to try and provide those kinds of services for their families. And so these are the types of choices that they were making.
How often are these women aware of the consequences of the heavy jail sentences that come out of these drug sentences?
Well, particularly when you're talking about what I call cross-border incarceration, where women are getting incarcerated in a country that is not their country of origin and in which they have not been living, they're very seldom aware of the real penalties. Oftentimes, though, they don't realize that the war on drugs is so intense. They don't realize that there's such a sort of immense moral outrage about drugs. And so they're very surprised when they end up in a courtroom and a judge delivers this kind of impassioned speech about the scourge of drugs being brought into the country by foreigners and needing to make an example of them. They're just not particularly aware that is the discourse that's going on within the country that they arrive in. And this was true also for women from West Africa who I also spoke to. Now, there's been some efforts to make women aware, and those have been particularly focused on, okay, put information out at the airports so that when, you know, you've already made a decision, you know, just about to get on the plane, but here's some information that's going to tell you if you get caught, you're going to jail for 5 years. Well, it's too late by that point, right? Women are dealing with oftentimes fairly violent men who are not going to take kindly to them going home and saying, well, I decided not to carry the drugs that you had already given me to carry across the border, right? So it's pretty naive to imagine that is actually going to have an impact. What really needs to happen is a dramatic transformation of these women's economic system situations. And because that's all about deep-rooted social change, and that really begins to bring us to the global inequities within the global economy, people don't want to deal with that. They want to deal with just the individual women's choices that come as a result.
How often are these women involved in situations where they're in relationships with abusive partners or being coerced by someone that's close to them?
You know, that was such a common story, and I just want to sort of mention another chapter in the book, which is by Beth Ritchie. She's an African-American scholar out of Chicago, and she talked about young African-American lesbians in the criminal justice system, and she actually talked with some young women in the Chicago juvenile justice system. And she definitely also talked about the ways in which even these women who identify as queer or as lesbians had violent and abusive men in their lives, oftentimes felt that they actually had to engage in straight sex just to be able to survive and to be able to get the kind of protection. And that was oftentimes tied up with also getting involved in the drug industry or the sex trade. And then that ended up with them becoming criminalized as well. So, we need to recognize that those kinds of violence and abusive relationships are really there, and coercion is very, very present. And it's not only within heterosexual relationships, but oftentimes even young queer women who have to actually deal with men as part of their survival strategies. And that's, I think, one of the really exciting articles. They're all exciting, but this is a particularly exciting article. Beth talks about queering anti-prison work, and she says that we really need to go beyond this assumption that when we start talking about, you know, men and women, it's always about heterosexual women. But things in real life and life on the street is much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've just mentioned these queer women in prison, and I mean, it seems like you're looking at women from all different walks of life, from all over the globe. What are the common themes of these people's stories?
Well, what was really amazing, I think, was that you could put some of these articles back to back from totally different parts of the globe and see almost similar stories. So, for example, there's a contribution by an Aboriginal woman from Australia called Robbie Keener. And Robbie Keener was a woman who was actually incarcerated, given a life sentence for killing her abusive partner after suffering very, very extreme violence from him. And she ultimately appealed her case, and it was successful. And actually her case was one that became quite famous because it really got people to recognize battered woman syndrome as part of, you know, reasons why women were not getting the kind of treatment they needed by the criminal justice system. And then you could look at an article by a group in South Africa called Justice for Women, which is working to get the release of women who have been incarcerated for killing their abusive partners. And it's actually been quite successful in making that issue public in South Africa and getting people to realize that these stereotypes about women who kill and these sort of violent, evil women is not true. So, you know, you sort of see these commonalities, these common threads running through women who are basically being criminalized for their survival strategies. And that's why I call the first section Criminalizing Survival. You also see the common thread of the prison industrial complex and the ways in which prisons have been growing all over the world. And so, you know, you have an article on the prison system in Portugal and seeing how there's been a massive increase in imprisonment there, which is particularly focused on North African women and men. And then, you know, you can sort of look at that in relationship to the article on the criminal justice system in U.S., looking at the prison industrial complex and its connections to U.S. militarism. So there's many common themes, and I think that as well as the common themes around why women are being criminalized, why women are being incarcerated, why societies are increasingly seeing prison as a solution to deep-rooted social problems and economic inequalities, there's also the commonality of resistance. And so the last section is called From Criminalization to Resistance, and it has articles about women who are coming together to think about innovative strategies to really challenge this prison buildup.
In this book, you use the prison industrial complex to explain why women are ending up in prison more and more. Can you explain what the prison industrial complex is?
Yes. Well, you know, that comes really out of my own activist work. So I was very involved since the mid-1990s with an organization called Critical Resistance that is an abolitionist organization that was started in California and has now got chapters all over the United States. And one of the things that Critical Resistance started to do was to look at why there was such a massive buildup of prisons in California. And it was particularly noticeable in California because I think in the 150 years up to 1984, there were only 12 prisons built in California. And then in the following years to 1996, there were 16 prisons built. So you could see this sort of dramatic turnaround in the mid-1980s, and you could suddenly see huge amounts of money being poured into constructing prisons and locking people away. And so Critical Resistance started to ask the question, who profits? Why are we building so many prisons? Who's really profiting from this? And they began to ask questions about what we call the political economy of prisons, but really, you know, we used to talk about it in terms of, well, who's profiting from the prisons? And we traced it back to not only companies that were building and running private prisons, but also corporations that were profiting from publicly run prisons. For example, telephone corporations that were charging huge prices for families to contact their loved ones inside, or corporations that were actually using prison labor as a cheap way of getting their goods made. So we began to sort of look at the ways in which a number of different groups and interests profit from building prisons and become reliant on prisons being built, and particularly in places like California's Central Valley or upstate New York or rural Ontario. We see that small towns, particularly the business communities of small towns and the political elites of small towns, start clamoring for prisons to be built because they see that as an economic driver or economic development, when in fact many factories and industries and agriculture are just being swallowed up and shut down as a result of globalization and free trade. So this is really what we mean when we talk about the prison industrial complex. It's the way it's become part and parcel of local economies that have become totally reliant on building and constructing and maintaining prisons, and the ways in which prisoners then become basically commodities in this system out of which people are profiting. And we shouldn't forget the politicians are profiting too, right? Maybe not financially, but politicians profit by getting the extra votes when they go on the campaign trail and start talking about getting tough on crime. So all of these factors play into the prison industrial complex. And what we wanted to show is that building and constructing prisons is not about keeping us safe, right? More and more prisons do not keep us safe. In fact, people eventually get out of prison. They come home. They are stigmatized. They find it hard to get jobs. It creates all sorts of instability within communities. It doesn't heal. It doesn't help people to deal with sexism and racism. In fact, it makes sexism and racism worse, and homophobia is entrenched within the prison system. So, these were sort of, we recognized, first of all, that prisons don't make us safe. So then we had to look at, well, okay, so what purpose do they serve? Whose interests do they serve? And they do not serve the interests of most people. And that's really what we mean when we talk about the prison industrial complex.
And it's interesting because, I mean, many studies have shown that crime rates are going down, yet more and more prisons are being built. And traditionally, it's mostly men that end up in these prisons. So why is it that more and more women, and particularly women of color, are ending up there?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because where if we look, we could look at England, we could look at Canada, we could look at the U.S., we see the number of women in prison is increasing at a faster rate than the number of men in prison. Now, of course, we know that, on the whole, women tend to be in prisons at a much lower rate than men. And historically, that has had to do with other types of social controls that are used to control women within the family, for example, patriarchy. But when we look at this massive increase, we have to also look at the war on drugs and the way that that has impacted on women, in particular women of color. You know, communities of color, as we know, have been decimated by the war on drugs. Native communities have been decimated by the war on drugs, not only by drugs themselves, but by the massive over-policing and over-targeting of our communities, and by the closing down of rehabilitation and the cutbacks to health care and support services for addicts. And so we end up with women both who are going into the drug trade because they have economic difficulties and they're trying to survive on a day-to-day basis. And we also have women who are living with addictions and are having less and less social services and social supports made available to them. So we can really see this sort of punitive approach to women with addictions, by, for example, the prosecution of women who have been given birth to children while they're addicted, right? Rather than thinking of that as a situation where the mother and the child need to be given health care, support, services. Instead, women are being criminalized and seen as child abusers, right? So I think that these factors all play into women's criminalization. It's the economic insecurity, which is coming out of the massive cutbacks that we've seen in all sorts of social services and in welfare, right, making it harder for women to survive. It's the crackdown on drugs without any support for women who actually have addictions. And it's the reliance that the whole family has on women on the whole, so that women feel that they have to make some difficult choices in order to try and help their families to survive.
I think what really struck me was I was reading an article that you wrote several years ago called Selling Black Bodies, and you gave the example of a pregnant woman who was arrested and sentenced for importing drugs into England, and then her mother was sentenced to 12 years in prison for not reporting her daughter to the police. How typical is this story?
Well, you know, we're increasingly seeing this intergenerational impact of prisons. Now, before, we used to talk about intergenerational impact, and we would mean that if a mother or father was imprisoned, then the child was likely to be also imprisoned. Now we're sometimes seeing three generations who've been imprisoned. Sometimes that's because the mother has a child in prison and then the grandmother or the grandparents in prison, and sometimes we're seeing family members being imprisoned alongside themselves. You know, the article and this isn't just in the U.S. or Canada, but there's an article in the book on the war on drugs and prisons in Portugal, and a wonderful woman, Manuela da Cunha, talks about the way in which prisons have just become an extension of the neighborhoods where poor people and particularly poor African immigrants live. And so we have these sort of extended families that are actually being incarcerated. So, I mean, this is becoming very common because what we have to understand is that it's particular neighborhoods that are being targeted. And so you have massive rates of people being snatched up from these particular neighborhoods and communities. And oftentimes that does mean that you actually have intergenerational or extended family members who are actually being imprisoned either together or one after the other. And we can only imagine, of course, the massive destruction that that causes. Stormy Ogden, who's a native Californian woman, wrote an article in the book, and she talks about her own experiences of being in prison. And she says that her grandfather was imprisoned, and she talks about the ways in which, as a native woman, historically her community, she comes from the Yokuts and Pomo Nations, had been put in prison for simply trying to hold onto their land rights. And then with the introduction of alcohol into the community, she suffered from alcoholism, and then that resulted alongside poverty in her becoming incarcerated. So you see these ways in which colonization has made this much intergenerational impact, right, where her grandfather was first in prison and then she's in prison, and she recognizes that that's that legacy and that history continuing, and she's making a commitment to try and break that cycle, but at the same time recognizing, you know, the massive odds that are against her. Stormy's now a really amazing prison activist, and she does a lot of work around Native women in prison who have been victims of violence. So, you know, those are sort of some of the stories that are in the book.
And what did you find in comparison to Canada in terms of what's happening here? Are the same things happening in Canada at the same scale as in other countries?
Well, Canada is an interesting case because the federal government on the whole has tried to go against the flow of U.S.-style mass incarceration, and so they've tried to at least feed in some understanding that massive buildup of prisons is not necessarily or is not the solution to poverty, to addiction, to mental health problems, and so on. On the other hand, at the same time, they continue to incarcerate poor women, Native women, women with mental health problems. And so there's a sort of contradiction in a way between the rhetoric and the reality. But at least the buildup has not been at such a scale at the federal level as it has the federal prison system in the U.S. But at the provincial level, we're actually seeing that many provinces are leaning towards the U.S. model. And in particular, they're even borrowing the actual architectural designs for building these super jails. So here in Ontario, for example, there's been the construction of three super jails, basically using the very same architectural designs that they have used in California, where they use sort of high-tech architecture, what they call sight lines, which means that a guard can see, is normally placed sort of at the center of this circle of cells, and then can see all around so that you need fewer guards for the same number of prisoners. And so it's a sort of a model which is based on how many people can you incarcerate for as little money as possible, right? So that's exactly the super jail model that has been imported into Ontario. And in fact, one of those super jails is actually run by a U.S. prison corporation. So it's not only a U.S.-style prison, it's actually a U.S. prison in Ontario, which is being, and of course the profits from that prison are being fed directly back across the border to the U.S. corporate headquarters. And Quebec is also going down that road of building a new private prison. So, you know, you're getting, it's a slower process, it's a slower pace, but you're still definitely seeing this sort of a push towards this prison industrial complex of seeing small rural towns, again, seeing prisons as economic development and economic drivers. We're seeing this sort of U.S.-style, you know, prisons for profit, lock people away for money. There's a really interesting article in the book by, it's a collaboration between Kim Pate, who works for the EFRI, which is the a women's advocacy group around prisons, and Lisa Neff. And Lisa actually is an Aboriginal woman who was incarcerated in Canada. And she was given the label of dangerous offender, and she was actually called at one point, inverted commas, the most dangerous woman in Canada. And this was for nothing she had actually done. It was for what the judge thought she would do, what she thought that what they thought she was potentially capable of. And basically, you know, Lisa was a young Aboriginal woman who had lived on the street and who was trying to survive. And this was basically what she was criminalized for. So, you know, this is a sort of example of how these ways of which, you know, criminalization of young women, criminalization of Native women, of women of color, are definitely very much present here in Canada. And we need not to be complacent, because we look across the border and we say, oh, well, you know, they've got over 2 million people locked up. We haven't got that. Well, of course not. And apart from anything, of course, Canada has a much smaller population. But certainly the incarceration rate in Canada is higher than most countries in Europe, for example. So there's everything to continue to struggle for here as well.
Now, you've mapped out a lot of different problems, a very large problem here. It seems like it's quite a beast. Where would you suggest we even start to resolve these problems?
Well, that was why I wanted to include a section in the book on resistance. I thought that was almost, you know, the most important thing to include. It's all very well having the analysis, but if we don't have tools to challenge it, then the analysis is really not that useful. And so the resistance section actually has some really wonderful articles. One of them is by Ruth Gilmore, who is an academic and an activist from California. And she talks about a group of women called the Mothers Reclaiming Our Children out of Southern California, and that is a grassroots group of mostly Black and Latina women who came together because, as it sounds like, you know, their children were being taken away from them and were being locked up, and they began to do a grassroots process of trying to understand and analyze why it was that their communities were being targeted and why it was that their children were being taken away. And they came to the conclusion, similarly to other articles and authors in the book, that it was not about protecting them or protecting their neighborhoods from their own children, but instead it was about policing and controlling their children and making sure that they didn't complain about the lack of resources that they had in their communities. And so I think that one of the things that that article shows us is that we're all affected by prisons, right? We're all affected when money is taken away from healthcare and put into building prisons. But some people and some communities are more affected because it's their children or it's because it's them. And so one of the things that we need to do is to build prison activist movements that really involve communities of color, involve Native communities, involve those who have been most directly affected, involve those who are coming out of prison. And, you know, the term reclaiming, I think, is really important because people coming out of prison are stigmatized. It's hard to get a job. Oftentimes they're looked at as, inverted commas, criminals. And we need to recognize that people coming out of prison are victims of a politicized prison system, right? And so as such, you know, we can work with former prisoners and not simply leave them on the sidelines or in the margins. I think that there are some really important and exciting activist organizations in Canada, joint effort out there in BC, the Prisoner Justice Action Committee that I'm involved in here in Ontario. And these groups are raising awareness of the conditions in prison. They are campaigning for prisoners' human rights. But even more broadly than that, they're demanding that people understand that prisons do not help to make us safe, and that instead we need to take that money, take those public funds, and invest them in education. We can have campaigns around things like education, not incarceration. We can demand that, you know, that money is put into healthcare, into drug rehab programs, into supporting women, into domestic violence shelters and education, so that women get the support that they need rather than simply being criminalized.
That was Julia Sudbury. She's the editor of a new book called Global Lockdown. The book will be available later this month in your local bookstore, or you can find it at www.routledge.com. Julia Sudbury was in Toronto. She's a visiting professor from Oakland, California.